Welcome everyone to today's compiler construction programming languages. So last time we did a few more high-level constructs for synchronizing your concurrent code, and we used wait-free instructions or wait-free algorithms to construct the locking data structures that we all know and love, and have terminated with monitors and condition variables to now come to the topic of deadlocks, which we buy ourselves into by using these kinds of data structures. So let's have a look at what we can say about those. So a deadlock, first of all, like a definition for this part of the lecture, is a situation in which two processes are waiting for the respective other to finish, and thus neither ever does. So, yeah, an example for that, let's consider a Java program, like the one from over there, where we said that Java supports the concept of monitors, would be, well, a particular class like this one here, foo, that has an attribute that points to another instance of the same class, and we say that we also have a method bar that we have flagged as triggering the entering of a monitor with a synchronized modifier, and within this thing we have somewhere a call to the same method from its peer object that we stored with another. And you might already see just from that code where we want to go with that. Particularly, we see a situation like the one down there, where we have two instances of this class pointed to by A and B, and we set the other attribute of each object to its respective peer. So we say that A's other points to B and B's other points to A. And then there's a lot of fuss going on in Java about like creating thread thingies and instantiate some runnable things that you give over to the thread and then start all that. And in order to make life simple and short, we will just claim that there's, well, those two methods are then started somehow concurrently. So this is not actual Java code, but you get what I mean with that. So now, where's the deadlock in all that? Well, you get from that that there's two threads, A and B, that execute A's bar and B's bar concurrently, and depending on the concrete scheduling, one of the runs might look the following way, such that A bar is able to acquire the monitor for A, whereas concurrently B bar acquires the monitor of B, and then during the execution of said method bar, at some point we might branch into the if body in a way that we then call the respective other's bar method, like this thing's going to be called with an A and with an B, and both of these bar methods are marked as being or as entering the respective monitor, which belongs to the respective object in the Java world. And well, if A tries to call others bar, it will have to acquire the monitor for its other thing, which is pointing to B, which concurrently has already acquired the monitor of B. So this thread blocks at that point. same thing is going to happen to thread B, which wants to at some point execute other point bar, which is then referring to bar in the object A, which is already acquired by thread A, and then those two things will block indefinitely. So this is what a deadlock is in a concrete example. So the question is now, how do you deal with these kinds of things? And can we do something from the programming language side to, well, deal with that? So first of all, what's crucial to deadlocks is, well known. So there's a few people that you might know from some other lecture already, maybe from operating systems. I don't know whether you have heard about deadlocks in there already. Is that part? And you know about these four criteria for deadlocks already? Well, then that's like a piece of cake for you. So you need certain conditions to be in place in order for deadlock to happen at all. So, and you need to have each of them be valid in your system. So you need mutual exclusion as a means of programming, so you can somehow trigger mutual exclusion. So this is what, for example, the monitors or the mutices give us. So these are the processes that do deadlock require some kind of exclusive access to something. You need a concept of waiting for this exclusive access. And what you need to hold there is that a process keeps possession of the locks that it has acquired so far while waiting for acquiring another one. So this is the second condition. Third condition is that you can't just simply take away the resources from the waiting threads. And the last thing is, in order for that to be actually really harmful, you need some way of circular wait. So there needs to be a cycle of processes that each wait for the other to release their resources in order to continue. And if there's a circle in this or cycle in this, then you get to a deadlock. So if such a deadlock happens, there's several ways of coping with that. So what can you do? Well, you can just hope for the best and ignore deadlocks and just say, well, if the conditions under which we form such a cycle are rare enough and we have a lot more other threads that just continue working, we could just ignore that. You can take this as you wish, but I would not consider that to be a decent strategy then. What else you could do is you could have some kind of higher instance, like the operating system, trying to keep the upper hand by checking whether there is an actual cycle in your resource management of several threads happening and whether they wait for each other. And, well, detection is nice and well. If you have some means of acting, it's even better. So if there is the ability to preempt the acquisition of the resources that lead to such a cycle in advance, then, well, this could be a good idea to check regularly whether you can run into such a cycle and just pause whoever is the candidate that creates the final piece in the cycle and wait until everything has changed around that and then only let this participant continue. The other way would be like prevention, in the sense that you try to per design of your programs create only programs that are actually really deadlock free. So this is like trying to somehow come to a situation where there can't be any deadlock at all. And you see me marking that already in green, so we will have a look at what we can do in that respect. And then there's the avoidance of OS tries to schedule so that they don't deadlock. So prevention is the thing that you, the only thing that is safe in the sense that you won't end up with deadlocks at all, and you don't need any further support from the operating system. So this works like on any operating system in that sense. So what can we do to achieve that? Well, there's, for example, one idea would be to make use of lock-free algorithms, since they don't use actual locks, but instead do these like try and repeat algorithms. This might already give you enough power to do what you want to achieve without running into actual deadlocks. But what about algorithms that actually do require locking? So let's maybe talk a little bit about detecting whether we run into a deadlock at some point. And for that, we try to set up a particular order on the locks that will allow us to, for once, detect whenever there is a cycle in this, well, in trying to set up an order between the locks. And for the other part, well, then just determine a way to arrange our newer attempts on locking so that they are fitting into the order that we determine. So for that, you can come up with a way of statically analyzing the program that is written, whether the way that locks are acquired in there are, in a certain sense, appropriate for preventing locks. And the idea is to have a look at the order or sequence in which locks are acquired. So in general, static analysis has a problem because, well, just trying to determine whether a program actually really ever terminates is already a thing that is not computable, which doesn't mean that you can't do anything meaningful with statical analysis. You might come up with or be interested in a property that is more easy to actually really infer, or you might relax a little bit on your demands and formulate the condition which you want to infer from your program so that it actually becomes decidable. So with the drawback of having a little bit more general assumptions on what happens in the program than would actually be valid for the program. So, well, let's maybe come to the concrete idea. So what we are interested in finding out about a program is the set of locks that are potentially held at a particular program point. And as a side effect, we want to keep track of the ordering in which we keep acquiring new locks, and we do that kind of at the same time, in that sense. So, first of all, what are these lock sets? We use sets of the locks that are in the acquired state at a program P, and we set up such a lock set for each of the program points, meaning after each instruction we introduce a new representation for a set where we keep the locks that we have so far found to be acquired at that program point, and we keep running through the program and refining these sets with the increasing information that we get by going through that, and we might in that sense add more and more locks to each of these sets as long as we realize that there are new locks taken at a particular program point. So these are the lock sets. What we need for setting up a partial order then is also the concept of transitive closure, but that is a thing that you should already know, so we can just apply the transitive closure on, for example, a relation between arbitrary elements, and this works in the way that you see it defined here. Well, you just, if you have relations that are connectable with one particular element, like this x2 here, and have other elements bound to them as x1 and x3, then we also assume that x1 and x3 are in the same relation. So that's all that we get from this transitive closure, and we continue to do so until we have satisfied the space that we can explore with that. So this is transitive closure, and then let's go over from lock sets to lock order, because during our analysis of a program and its function bodies, its structures in there, we will run through and keep track of the locks that are held at a program point. Particularly, there is particular instructions that trigger new locks to be held in the following lock set after that instruction is passed, and we usually then put these locks L prime into the lock sets where we take the set of locks held before we pass that instruction, copy them to after this instruction, and add the lock that we have mentioned in this particular instruction. And at the same time, what we do is we extend the lock order, which is one of those relations between locks in that case, by this lock L prime being now the right operand of this lock order for each of the locks that we find being held before the acquire ring instruction is treated. And this is a thing that we then add to the lock order, and in the end the transitive closure of all that gives us the global lock order of the whole program. We can now use that in order to make some statements about whether a program is free of deadlocks. Particularly, what we can say is if we don't have a circle, which would mean that if in our global lock order, when we have finished analyzing our program, when we don't find that some lock A is in lock order with itself, then the whole thing is deadlock free. As soon as we have lock being ordered in that way, we know that there's a cycle in our definition of the lock order, and the whole thing, we can't say then that it's free of deadlocks anymore. So this is like the central theorem that we use for analyzing programs. This looks quite nice, but it has a certain property that is to do with that static analysis is always a little bit imprecise. This just gives us that the program is actually free of deadlocks. What it doesn't say is that if we find such a circle, then there is an actual real deadlock in there. So this is just a one-way statement that we get of that. So this just enables us to actually really prove that there is no deadlock in case that we find no cycle in there. So the imprecision is on the side of when there is such a cycle, we might not actually have a real deadlock in a program. Why is that? Well, there's several sources for that, particularly two we mentioned here. One is the thing that we also have to deal with monitors, and monitors are usually re-entrant structures, and for re-entrant structures it's not so easy to actually say that whenever we have found a cycle with that, whether that is an actual problem in the real world or not, because, well, monitors are designed to be re-entered in that sense. The other thing that comes from static analysis is that we don't really simulate real programs. We just compute the effect of the program on all possible inputs, and we only analyze for a finite time the code that we are given. So we will probably not be able to compute all the possible runs of that. So we usually do some kind of over approximations. We do a few or we do a few assumptions that don't actually really hold for the computation to be over in finite time. So what we usually do for that is, for example, that we that we collapse several concrete instances of semaphores, blocks, or mutexes into one, in order to not have to reanalyze for each and every instance of a lock that is created. How that looks like is a thing that I want to show you in the following example. And here you might realize that this is not the slides that are online. I'm sorry for that. I tried to load them up in advance, but turns out that there's such things as maintenance modes of typo 3, and this is what caught me this time. So no actual slides in advance this time. I'm sorry for that, but well, I'm gonna put them online as soon as maintenance mode is done for our homepage, so bugger that. Anyway, this example now for Luxet order in practice. So what we need to come up first is some kind of representation for locks and lock sets there. What I choose for this thing is that this is a sort of a Java setting here, that example from a few slides earlier. In Java setting, what we have is that there's a synchronized. I have said to you that synchronized is kind of instantly translated into this monitor enter and monitor leave by the actual compiler. And the monitor itself is usually associated with the object that is the current object in that sense, the this. So the monitors in that sense are usually chained to particular object instances. So object instances are created where? Well, they are created at new instructions. So in order to kind of disambiguate between certain locks in there, what I usually do for these examples here is to take all locations where objects are created like this and take the respective lines of code where these happen as the identifiers for locks in case that they are at some point acquired. So what you need for doing the algorithm from before then is some kind of way of telling what instances of objects reach which enter and leave instructions in order to tell about the locks that are kept at that particular program point. So with this way of identifying certain locks, is this now an approach that merges several lock instances into one, or does it keep lock instances apart from each other? What would you say? Does that disambiguate between all possible instances of logs that there are, or do I do some kind of grouping of logs into one representation? Is this a unique representation? Who's in favor for that? Is this like a grouping representation? Who thinks that? Okay, why is that? This is what you were fearing, weren't you? Thing is, when you reach these things, you need to in a unique case, you needed to map the value that reaches there with one real heap object that is flying around somewhere. The problem with taking these line numbers of constructor calls is, well, who says that this line is only passed once during the run of your program? In case you keep reaching this line one for several times, for example, then you still represent all of the constructor calls and thus all heap objects that there are just with this one line, one, and then have several instances of logs grouped within one abstract value in that sense. So this is an approach that collapses several instances to one in order to better compute for that. But still, let's see how far that gets us. So then what we do is we set the other attribute of each other's object to the respective peer, and then start the bar calls, and well, you see me fiddling a little bit with the syntax from before. So this is like, this is there to get you an idea of what value is used in the monitor. Then, so what I do is I make this this part of the method call explicit by pulling it into the actual arguments of the method call, which means that you can really see that it's the address of A that goes into the first parameter of bar in that sense, or the address of B that goes in this thing. So, we will see that program at some point will reach this concurrent execution, which means that bar is then called once with pointing to A and once pointing to B. And, well, that's that. After that, we are finished with analyzing the first part, and then we continue with analyzing function bar. And what we do here is, I do it now explicitly because here is actual real log sets gonna be determined for this part of the algorithm. So up until the point where we enter this method, we don't have any logs taken, at least as far as we can tell. So, so far we set up then for line 8 that we don't have any logs so far. Then we continue analyzing, and we hit a monitor enter, which is an instruction that acquires a monitor in this case. And for that to work, what we do is we have to look at the parameter that's given to the monitor, and this is bound to, well, in this case, address of A and address of B, because here they have been possibly started with that. And here you also see another concept in this static analysis. You don't disambiguate, at least depending on what tools you choose, but for this part here, you don't disambiguate between the call that originated from the left thread and the call that originated from the right thread, but you throw them all into one bowl and just say, well, this can be either A or B. So with that information, you can still fill the set of potentially held logs at that point with L0 and L1 being the representations for line 0 and line 1 in that sense. Why is that? Because this A has been created in line 0 and B has been created in line 1. So this you propagate further on in the algorithm. So this will be in the program. So this will at some point reach this bar thing. And before we do this method call, we already have that the locks L0 and L1 are held. So what else is there? Well, other also has a value, and this is again. Where do we get that from? Well, we could disambiguate between all of these heap objects, but if we do that, then we will end up with a lot of different computations that we just can't afford to do in order to come up with a result in decent time. So we again over-approximate and just decide to keep all possible assignments that are done to the other attribute of a foo object into one, so they end up being in this state. Other can be possibly A or B. So if there's another call to that with the context of the of the lock sets being already L0 and L1, this leads to a reanalysis of this method, this time with L0 and L1 being possibly possessed by the thread that executes bar. Again, we have in the parameters possibly A or B, and when we now do a monitor enter, we already have L0 and L1 possibly in possession. We possibly take up monitors A or B, which means, well, we don't really know what exactly happens there. So what we in that case, we do combine each and every of those things with each other, which lets us come up with the pairs L0 and L1 and L1 and L0, which means that we get that L0 is log ordered before L1, and possibly L1 is log ordered before L0. So with that, you already have the cycle that is kind of vicious for program execution without deadlocks. So there the algorithm has already yielded that there is a possible deadlock in there. And as we have already had a closer look into this example, this is actually really the point where in the real world the deadlock happens. So although we have had a lot of imprecise moments in this algorithm where we just over-approximated all possible values and put them into one combined thing and then had to combine them with another over-approximation, we still got the actual point where the deadlock is. Of course, this is in that example, well, it's tailored that way. You might also find a lot of other spots in a program where this over-approximation would yield this is a possible deadlock. However, you can't really find a concrete example for a deadlock that happens. But still, what is to be taken away from this is as long as this thing doesn't find any deadlocks with these over-approximations, which just make life more like. Well, it yields more more warnings than they actually really happen. And if it doesn't yield any warnings, then you can be sure that there is no deadlock happening. So, yeah, this is kind of just the very basic idea of how to set up such a system to infer lock set and lock set order, which is quite, at this moment, quite coarse in that sense, and you would like to be more precise in many ways probably, but there's ways of keeping apart certain instances of log sets depending on the ways that you represent each of these things. So you can work upon the representation of each log in that sense. You can work upon the interpretation of function calls in there in order to keep several function keys apart. You can work upon the if you do this keeping apart of particular function calls, you can also work on the way that parameters are considered to be passed. So for one call you might have one parameter, for one other call the other parameter, and all that. And this makes your results that such an algorithm yields much more precise, in the sense that you eliminate a lot of false warnings in that sense. And the crucial point in setting up such a static analysis system is to design it in such a way that it still keeps to be computable, but is precise enough so that you are not overwhelmed by a lot of false positives in that sense. And yeah, with that you can come up with an algorithm that finds these deadlocks. So you wanted to add something? Please speak up a lot. I don't understand.
So you mentioned when the algorithm is log positive, when it doesn't give us any warnings, then we can be sure that no deadlocks will happen.
Yes.
But we still have this search space problem, right? That's really not really computable if we have too many logs there.
You have to design the over approximations in a way that they are finite in the end. Otherwise the algorithm will be infinite. Yes, that's right. So the reentrant logs are still a thing that you can only if you disambiguate between threads in this setting, then you can say a little bit more about reentrant things. This would also be a proposition which you could add to static analysis to find some way of representing threads in there. But yeah, it's all each of these each feature that you add to that makes life more complex for the analysis, and well, takes a lot more time than just the simple things. And with the simple things, you already get quite far in that. Yeah, but so, yeah, as you said, it's kind of black magic to design your representations of all these components in there in a way that they keep finite and keep, even if they're infinite, you just need to make sure that at some point you will give way to the infinity by just saying, well, be infinitely many locks or something like that, but you need to work on that part if your representation is infinite, for example. And yeah, that's what static analysis people really do usually. Anyway, the thing with these kind of tests is that usually doesn't really hurt to have more warnings for deadlocks in these things, for people to just eliminate the cause for that particular warning. If you just say that only those programs that are proven to be deadlock free are permitted on the system, then you will still keep the system running without any deadlocks. So false positives are in that sense on the safe side if your top priority is creating things that don't deadlock, in that sense. So, yeah, I think we have already talked a lot about that, so maybe let's round up with logs. One thing maybe on this notion of annotating particular sections of the code as atomic in contrast to having the explicit calls for weight and signal and all that, there's a difference in expressiveness in a particular sense. So you can, for example, express the following thing when you explicitly use locks. So you can have this wait and signal using that manually. And you can, for example, weave another call of wait and signal in there, which you guard each time with some different condition, for example, or even with the same condition. But this is a thing which is hardly expressible with just marking certain fractions of your code as being atomic in that sense. So with explicit calls to wait and signal, you have some kind of freedom of where you want to distribute your calls to the respective wait and signal things a lot more than otherwise. You can also, for example, just have the wait being called in one function and the signal in a completely different function. This is also a thing that you can't do with atomic scopes, because these scopes need to be nested. You can't really distribute the atomic scopes between several functions, for example. So this is a different way or different expressivity that you get when you can explicitly call wait or signal in that sense. So they are not, in that sense, exchangeable. You can't really, in every case, replace this wait and signal thing with an atomic annotation. Why do I tell you that? Because we will, in the next thing, talk about some ways of realizing atomic blocks with a few other means. But anyway, as an outlook, what we have seen, the mutices we have seen are able to express mutual exclusion, so we could use them in order to implement atomic sections based on locks. You can a little bit adjust the amount of concurrency that you enable in your systems by making use of several locks for particular purposes. You can have very specific lock for just changes to a data structure, while you have another lock for having read-only accesses to certain things, for example, or just lock for different parts of your object. So there's several ways of designing your algorithm when you do these atomic sections with locks in that sense. You might even realize that for certain critical sections, if they are never accessed by any other thread, then you don't even need to use a particular lock, but that's kind of the trivial case. You might also want to have a look at the way that the locks are acquired, so that you don't run into one of these sequences of that might end up in a circle. And if you really want to make sure that you never run into that thing, you might want to use the same lock order that is circle free for each of the cases that you start acquiring locks. This might need for you to rearrange the acquiring process maybe a little bit when you realize that at one point you might run into a cycle due to having missed a particular lock that would have been needed to insert a little bit earlier in your lock order. So what you then do is you release a whole lot of other locks just to grab this new lock and then reacquire them. And this is maybe a thing that's quite expensive to do. And this might be a thing that you would like your programming language to do for you instead of doing that manually. So a small notion on concurrency across particular languages. And there was this idea of atomic operations for wait-free algorithms. This is a thing that you usually get in languages like C and C++. In languages that are a little bit higher level, like Java and C#, you get ways of accessing monitors and/or semaphores also, and like a small overview on what you get in which language. So you have in C, C++, you have barriers, which you can't really access directly from Java or C Sharp. However, there's this idea of volatile as a modifier that will give you automatic placement of barriers in that sense. Then there's wait and lock-free algorithms that you can realize in C and C++ directly in that sense. And in, for example, Java and C Sharp, you get those exposed to you via some particular API extensions that are in the library. So, yeah, this Java util concurrent atomic or system threading interlocked would give you access to wait and lock-free instructions. Then there's semaphores, which are, via particular libraries like the pthreads, for example, usable from C and C++. In Java, you usually try to encapsulate all that in some particular special purpose object that is then based on actual monitors to simulate the behavior of semaphore. And then there's monitors that are then usually accessible from Java and C Sharp, and there's ways of doing that in C, C++ also. But there you see a little bit how shifted those concepts are when you consider whether they are available in certain languages or not. So as a summary for this part of the lecture, we have seen different concurrency algorithms. There were wait-free, lock-free, and locked algorithms. What we haven't seen so far is transactional features, which will be the next part of the lecture. For wait-free algorithms, we have seen that they never block, they always succeed, never deadlock, and there's no starvation, but they are very, very limited in expressivity. And there's lock-free algorithms that are made up from wait-free constructs, which never block in that sense, but may fail, and due to retrying over and over and over again, may starve at some point. Also, the invariant that they are keeping intact may only span a few bytes, depending on your architecture, 8 bytes, for example, on integers. That's the largest data structure that you can access with one of these locked instructions that you can use for lock-free algorithms. And then there's the locking algorithms, like semaphores and monitors, that can guard arbitrary code. You can do some kind of fine-grained concurrency by using several locks, but what you buy yourself into is that they may deadlock. And you have to choose between semaphores and monitors, depending on whether you want to have re-entrancy or not. And depending on your actual needs, you should now know where to look for the construct that supports whatever you want to do best. So if you're more interested in those things, you can have a look at those two publications, which I have also used for that part of the lecture. So now the next thing that might be interesting now is, let's have a look at the transactions, because that is what we then have as the next level of concurrent programming. So, transactions. First, a little bit of a motivation. Why would you want to have more than just monitors or locks in there? So there's a few kind of design ideas behind wanting more than just plain semaphores that have to do a little bit with ease of programming and things like producing stable code. And what plays a major role in that is two fundamental concepts from software engineering, which is abstraction and composition. So what you would like to have is that an object is really taking care about whatever is done to it in its internals, and it usually is supposed to not expose the internals of itself to the outside. And with those abstract entities, then you would like to compose larger pieces of software by then just taking each of them that take care of themselves and just define how they interact with each other. So, and they usually are supposed not to meddle with the internals of the other object. And with that, you would like to compose larger pieces of software. So let's have a look at an example. Like a linked list data structure that is offering something like a push and a for all interface method. And this serves as kind of a basic building block for what we want to achieve. And the next larger thing that we want to create out of that by composition would be like a set object that internally uses the list object for keeping book of the items that are in that particular set. The thing that you would like to expose, for example, would be a thing like a push. So, the insert is the thing. So the push is the thing that you want to use from the linked list as well as the for all. And if you consider concurrent programming environments, you might be interested in protecting the internal invariants of, for example, the linked list from external influences. So you would probably like to wrap the methods from the linked list with mutex acquire and releases to make them thread safe. The same thing probably goes for the implementation of the set implementation, because you would probably also want to have that in a thread safe way. However, what you will get is that you would like to call the methods from the inner object within the methods of the outer object, and what you would like in that sense is some kind of connection between the way that you protect the access of the outer object to the way that the inner object does. However, with having internal mutexes, this is a little bit difficult, because you can't really use the same mutex without exposing the mutex itself to the outside some way. So mutexes for compositional purposes are probably a bad idea to use. So what could you use instead? And the idea that pops up in that respect is usually the one from transactional memory. So what's the general idea behind that? You would like constructs like the ones that we had in last lecture, I think, with the atomic keyword and the block that is then supposed to happen in an atomic way. And this is supposed to mark on a very high level that the statements that occur within the scope are then executed atomically. But you also so this is an example of how that might happen, and this also illustrates a few features of what transactions are supposed to have. So first of all, there's this notion of executing the code in an atomic way in that sense. What you would also want from that is what you see here with that thing, that nested atomic blocks are not adding any particular further semantics to that. So if you happen to encounter something like that, you can just ignore that. They just are flattened in that sense to just being still atomic. What you also want to have is, of course, that this thing runs without conflicts from other threads. So this is kind of naturally the case for these atomic things. And if there is actually real interaction in the reality, then you would like for this thing to kind of undo the computation that you have done so far, since the assumptions that you have had on the resources that you accessed in there have been meddled with, and restart the transaction anew in order to try to make it count this time. What you also usually expect is that there's a kind of a retry keyword, which would, well, I don't know whether it's similar to the weight of the monitors. I would just say that this is explicitly triggering a new try of computing the content of the atomic block while discarding the so far done progress. So what would be the semantics of transactions then in programming languages? So transactions are things that you have probably all already heard in lectures that have something to do with databases. And if that's the case, then you usually know about these four-letter abbreviations, ACID. So what does that stand for? This is usually abbreviation for atomicity, consistency, isolation, and durability. So these are the aspects that characterize the transactions. And since we are talking about programming languages and not about databases here, we might want to clarify what each of these things mean now when that we talk about memory interactions in programming languages. So atomicity is pretty pretty similar to how this is treated in databases, I would say. So the transaction appears to either have completed or not to have run at all. So it's just a single step thing in that sense. So since they are not actually things that can be always directly mapped to some hardware instruction that really is, in that sense, uninterruptible. This is we add the notion of it seems that, or it's observable that it's it either completes or has to run. So it might actually be realized with several steps, several instructions inside that are not atomic in the implementation, but the surrounding infrastructure makes it appear as being atomic. And this is, well, this concept of failure atomicity in contrast to what actual real atomic executions give you. Consistency, what does that mean? Well, this means that the transactions act as transformers between consistent states, and a consistent state is considered to be consistent because there are certain invariants that are meant to hold for a consistent state, and what that now means is really dependent on the application. So each application that you have might have different invariants in play, so this is completely open in that sense. It's usually just some dependencies between several resources that are expressed in these invariants. And so this is a thing, well, since this is application dependent, you can't really guarantee that from the system at some point, but as long as within your transaction you re-establish the invariance before you exit a transaction, then, well, since the whole thing is observable only as either having run or having not run at all, then this is in that sense the same as if you would just transform from consistent state to another consistent state, always with the assumption that during the transition you if you break an invariant, do you reestablish it before you leave the transaction? So the next thing is maybe isolation. So of course, what you want to have is that transactions don't interfere with each other. That is, probably quite the way that you expect that. What you get in systems like these, in contrast to pure transaction-based systems, is that there is usually also the notion of code that is non-transactional. So there might be code out there that is not surrounded with these atomic markers, and well, this then creates code that doesn't it's just translated in the standard way, which is usually not keeping track of whether we interfere with a transaction or not. And in that case, isolation is a thing that you would have to reevaluate a little bit. You don't know what these systems then, what isolation means in those systems. The last point is this durability thing, and usually when we talk about transactional systems in programming languages, we mean durable with respect to the main memory in that sense. And as soon as we have committed our transactional effects into the main memory, we consider them to have endured enough. So whatever happens with the machine afterwards, we don't really care. As soon as it has reached the main memory, the transaction is done with everything that it has achieved. So in terms of what the semantics of the transactions then should mean at some point, is that the result of the concurrent transactions must be identical to one particular execution of them in sequence. So a particular execution is then a valid execution with respect to the transactions if you could come up with one particular serialization of all the concurrent transactions that corresponds to what you see on that machine. So it's kind of there must exist one serialization property. Then a little bit on things that are maybe a little special due to the nature of what you can do in a general purpose programming language: the consistency during the actual transaction. So these ACID properties are usually all about transactions that do behave and try to really achieve a result and are isolated from each other and all that. An issue that happens is that there is obviously at some point the potential for failure in systems. For example, there might be a transactional system designed in a way that it decides after a transaction has reached the end of its code whether the machine state was kept pristine during its execution, and if it had not been, then the transaction is cancelled at that point and completely re-rolled and done again. Such a system might have as a consequence that during the execution of the transaction, although it is cancelled in the end, in between it might see a state that is not really isolated from everyone else and might react to such a thing in some unforeseen ways in that sense. So if that happens, then we have some kind of a zombie transaction in that system. And well, if everything behaves well and you're lucky, then the best thing that happens is that it's just aborted in the end. However, there can be much more damage than just lost computational time. Instead, what you can have is a real havoc, like some kind of interrupt being triggered or some kind of trap being run into. There's the example over here where you have this one transaction that sets x to 10, y to 10, which is supposed to preserve the invariant x is y, and whatever it has been before, usually it also is keeping to that invariant. Maybe x is 0 and y is 0. When you find yourself at that point between those two instructions, you have temporarily broken the invariant and reestablished it afterwards. And in the system, as I've sketched it before, which decides only after you have done your transaction whether this was is considered to be a failure or a success, you might run into the thing from the other side where you have you read out the value of x, read out the value of y, and then, for example, rely on this invariant in some way. This is a very simple thing that relies on the invariant being intact, like you just test whether the invariant is intact and otherwise do something really horrible like assertion fail or something. And usually in these transactional systems, you would consider the invariant to be in place all the time because you're already using such a transactional memory system. However, it turns out, well, for this failed or at some point failing transaction, this might not be a guaranteed thing, and this might end in some horrible things like division by zero or anything that really gets your machine state into trouble. So this is a thing that you have to pay attention to. So, yeah. And in that respect, what you do is you you talk about another property that is not covered by this ACID thing, which is the opacity of your transactional memory system. And the transactional memory system provides opacity if even for the transactions that are doomed to fail, if even those are serializable into your sequence of transactions without causing any harm. So in that sense, that a system provides opacity if the failing transactions don't ever see an inconsistent state. So yeah, that's that. So this is an additional property that comes into play when you talk about these general purpose programming language things. So the next thing that we need to clarify is talking about isolation. And there's the notion of so-called weak and strong isolation in transactional memory systems. So what the question usually is in that respect is, can we somehow mix transactions with code that accesses the memory that is touched by transactions in a non-transactional way? And then there's two notions of that. There's, for once, the strong isolation that still guarantees isolation of the transactions from everything that the non-transactional parts of the programs do. So this is strong isolation. And then there's weak isolation, which only gives guarantees about the relations between the transactions that are actually really marked as transactions and don't give any guarantees about the non-transactional parts. So there's no conflict detection between those. So all of a sudden, although you are in a transactional memory system, you still buy yourself into situations that you would have liked to circumvent with transactions. So you get, for example, your standard race problems, like here in this, where you have a thread that that writes X with 42 and some other thread that reads from that thing, and well, depending on how fine granular your actual store to that thing is, you might end up with this this TMP thing being completely garbage, for example. So the question is, in such systems, how do you define the semantics of your system then, given that there is transactional parts and non-transactional parts? And one way of doing so there's several ideas of how you can still come up with a model of how those things interact, but one of them is the so-called single log atomicity model. This is a model where the program executes as if all the transactions are organized in a single program-wide mutual exclusion. So this maximizes minimizes concurrency of these transactions as far as it can get, in the sense that no two transactions can be executed at the same time, which doesn't matter anyway in that sense. It's just more stronger than it would need to be, but still it's a valid sequence of transactions that you can get out of that. But this then are the arrangements that you then use in order to mix into the parts that are non-transactional, and whatever race you can get out of these kinds of sequences are supposed to be valid computations in that setting. So this is just in order to clarify what computations are then valid in there. Yes?
Aren't transactions by definition don't interfere?
The transactions all in these weak isolated systems also don't interfere with each other. So you can safely just use one log for them, and they don't interfere with each other anymore. But the non-transactional parts are the ones that cause havoc. And in weak isolated systems, they can actually raise transactions. Yeah, and then there's the strong isolated transactional systems where even non-transactional accesses are supposed to not interfere with transactions in that sense. So these are the ones that are maybe more intuitive when you talk about transactions in that sense. Yeah, but there's two notions of that, and I just want you to be aware of that fact. So if you think about this single log atomicity thing being a useful general model for specifying the semantics of transactional systems, well, it's a simple model. I guess you immediately understand what the semantics of that would be, but might not be aware of the actual consequences that that has in terms of how strong your restrictions actually are that you impose when you consider transactions in the SLA model. So there are several points. For example, the first one, where we have a thread like the one on the left-hand side that initiates a transaction, and what it does is it just loops infinitely often. And then you have thread 2, which also does a transaction, and there it just does ordinary stuff that will terminate at some point. So now, depending on the actual scheduling, you might run the problem that as soon as thread 1 is scheduled and reaches its transaction, it never touches anything in memory. There's no memory cell modified or anything. So in principle, from a transactional point of view, there's just nothing that keeps you from really executing the transaction from thread 2. However, in the SLA model, for mutual exclusion reasons, there's only one single lock for all possible transactions. Thread 2 will never be executed, since it competes for a lock that is already taken, although thread 1 just doesn't do anything with the memory at all. Well, this is a quite strong thing, so this keeps your program from progress as soon as it has a transaction and one of the threads just runs havoc in its transaction. Another thing that is pretty, you might not have seen immediately, is the thing that is under point 2. So what do we have there? There's one thread that sets two flags, like data 1 and ready also 1, and just does a sneaky little call to one of these atomic blocks in there. And then there's thread 2, which, well, first of all, reads out whatever we find in data. So it accesses a shared variable, and then does the ready thingy. And if you look a little bit closer with that, you will see that you can only execute the transaction to the right whenever, well, the thread 1 is not in the atomic thing. And with that, what you get actually is that you really get this atomic without anything in its body to act as a barrier in that sense. Since, well, this makes sure that those two things are read only one after the other. And this already is like a violation of the isolation between those two things, because they, in that sense, can be used to synchronize between each other. And you might not want to have something like that in a transactional system. So what's in the alternative, or one of the alternatives of the SLA model? Well, there's, for example, a thing like transactional sequential consistency as alternative or rival model to that. So what are the reasons for that? Why would you want to have that? Well, we would, for example, want to get rid of the blocking behavior of locks in that sense, and also take away this means of synchronization in order to isolate from each other more. So what would be a possible candidate? This would be transactional sequential consistency, which just says that within each transactions, all the accesses that are happening are supposed to be sequentially consistent. What do we get from that? We would get, for example, situations like these, where we could make sure that there's overlap actually happening, as long as the variables that are accessed don't interleave each other in a particular way. So, in that sense, you can concurrently work on both of these transactions, although they work with similar variables, as long as for each of the variables inside each of the transactions, sequential consistency is guaranteed. So in that sense, the transactional sequential consistency gives you strong isolation still, but allows parallel execution. However, what was allowed in this single lock atomicity was reordering of instructions in each of the transactions, since, well, in a single lock atomicity, you can just do what you want within your transaction. In TSC, this is not valid anymore, because we require them to be sequentially consistent. Thus, all these optimizations like this write buffer, invalidate buffer, and all that is in that sense not allowed in there. So what is a practical model that is usually used in real implementations of transactional memory? Well, what you get there is that TSC is like the basis, the basic concept for the semantics of transactions, but what you usually also allow is that some reorderings are allowed, usually ones that create race-free situations. So, there's still a little bit of time left, so we should we Well, maybe we can get into the software transactional memory a little bit. So let's have a look into one realization of transactional memory. There's, well, if you read there's software transactional memory, you can usually guess that there's also the alternative hardware transactional memory, which we'll probably not get into today, but let's have a look at software transactional memory. So this is one way of implementing the atomic blocks in a more general way as the ones that we have seen last time. But we have also indicated already in the last lecture the implementation idea that we want to have for that, particularly what we want to use for realization of the atomic blocks is like some kind of lock-based structure underneath. Anyway, how would we would some automatic mechanism like a compiler try to realize these atomic blocks? Well, there would usually be some translation of this atomic block into a structure like there, where you have a do-while loop, where at the beginning of the do, you start the transaction with an explicit start transaction thing, and then try to commit a transaction in the end, and if that fails, then you would redo the whole thing with a new start transaction. So, what else do you need to do? Well, the code that you have specified in the atomic blocks, you would need to make that compatible to the software transactional memory system. And, well, what needs to be done there is that every piece of memory that you touch during the execution of this atomic thing would need to be rewritten from plain access to some address into a special version of that that wraps particular code around that. For read access of a variable, you would use this read transactional call instead, and for a write to a particular variable, you would use this write transactional, and with that you rewrite all the code parts that are in there. So this is usually a thing that you can do with a thing like a preprocessor or within a particular compiler. This depends on the actual application of that. And you might wonder whether you need to attribute the complete code part in there with all these read and write accesses. You can try to put a little bit more intelligence into that, and if you can prove that certain variables are like local to just that particular code, you might want to exclude them from being annotated with these read transactional and write transactional things. So with a good static analysis, you can spare a lot of annotations of that code a little bit. But in general, you would just annotate all the accesses to variables with these wrapping things. And the accesses to these variables you would translate into transactional memory compatible things. Also, then there's this retry keyword, which you would have to translate into some particular library call that does the whole thing in transactional memory. So how do you then implement these read transactional, write transactional, commit transactional, start transactional instructions? Well, from a software or from some managing entity, like some implementation of a software transactional memory, you would have several choices of how to design that thing. Usually you would initiate some kind of transaction descriptor as soon as you start the transaction, and then do certain entries in there depending on your general principle. So you might start in your transaction descriptor some kind of undo log in case that you propagate your changes directly to the memory. And in case that you need to roll back, you would have to do all these undo or run through all the undo entries in your undo log. Or if you go the other design path, you would collect all the writes that you need to do to the main memory in a so-called redo log and postpone them until the commit is finally happening, and then do them all in a batch in that sense. What you also keep is some kind of read and write sets of all the locations that you have accessed in that sense, and usually you also introduce some notion of versioning into the whole system by keeping like a logical timer in your system, and each time that you touch a certain variable, you look at the version that this particular variable or address has at that point, and then compare at the end of the transaction whether this version has changed or not, and then decide whether your transaction has been successful or not. An example that we will treat here is one implementation of a transactional memory system in software, which is this TL2 software transactional memory, which is has certain properties. This is one that provides opacity, so there's no inconsistent states in this system. It uses lazy versioning, which means that the writes are stored in a redo log, so this is going to the implementation of that point. And as soon as you access an address that is modified compared to the start of your transaction, then the transaction is usually meant to abort. So what is the principle behind that? You obtain a version from the global logical clock at the start of the transaction, which you consider as being the read version, and watch out for accesses to addresses that are flagged with a newer version than the version that you have extracted at the start of the transaction to determine whether you fail and retry or actually really commit to memory. So if you perform a read transactionally from a particular address, what you do is you check for the object version, whether it's younger than the transaction start. This is the case when somewhere someone else has written into that particular object, then you usually fail. What else is there? Well, you might check whether this particular object is locked at the moment of access. Why is that? Well, the way that TL2 propagates its changes into the actual main memory is by locking in the end when you do the commit. And when the object of interest is locked, then usually someone else is in the process of writing a change into that. So this is usually also a cause for you to abort. Yeah, and what it then returns is the read value and adds the accessed memory into the read set. Write transactionally, what it does is, well, it just updates the location in the redo log. So it just appends an entry in the redo log. So a commit is when it succeeds, what it does is it picks up locks for each written object that you find in the redo log, increments the global version, the global counter, to a new number, because this is then the new version that is created by this transaction, and checks the read objects whether they are still up to date or have been changed in between. This is why you have this read set in your transaction descriptor, to be able to discern whether someone else has interfered with you or not. And in that sense, before writing the redo log to memory, what was there? These are the things that are done before we do the actual write-down of the redo log. So what we usually have as a life cycle of such a transaction is we start the transaction, there's several reads and writes in there, during which the memory state seems to be consistent in that sense. If we detect that there is an inconsistency, we immediately roll back. But at some point, if everything works out fine, we reach the commit TX, where then the actual change is propagated into the transactional memory system by incrementing global log, validate the read set, and do the actual write of the redo log. Yeah, so this is what this TL2 is all about. Yeah, there's a few observations on that. The read-only transactions just need to check whether the versions are consistent in that sense. So there's no need to increment the global clock in the commit. This is some kind of optimization that you can do in there. What else you will see is that there is the need of locks in there. So as soon as values are written within the transaction, you have the need for locking memory, and this already rings the bell for deadlocks. Deadlocks can be happening in there. So in order to deal with them, you have to take up clever choices like a lock order that you establish on all the objects in there so that you can never deadlock with any other transaction, and that's usually that. So the whole the bottleneck in the whole system might be the global clock that needs to be accessed from each and every transaction, but well, that's what you get in such a system. So now that we have reached 10 minutes to 2, I think we will stop with the general challenges in software transactional memory and then also have a look at what hardware transactional memory gives us next time. So with that, I would say have a nice day, and we'll see us next week. Thank you.